I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to William A. Galston, Ezra K. Zilka Chair in the Brookings Institution's Governance Studies Program and College Park Professor at the University of Maryland. We're discussing his 2018 book, Anti-Pluralism, The Populist Threat to Liberal Democracy, from Yale University Press. Galston works on contemporary liberal theory and public policy, and his books include Liberal Pluralism and Liberal Purposes, as well as several other books, many edited volumes, and articles. Let me say, first of all, Bill Galston, thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
My pleasure. I took a look at the list of my predecessors, and it's an honor to join them.
Well, Bill, I love reading the book, like I like reading all the other books. This is a great job. I like it. Your book, Anti-Pluralism, takes up the challenges to liberal democracy today, and I found it very even-handed, historically, empirically informed, and very illuminating the contemporary situation and where we go from here. It was also fun as a political theorist to sort of discern your previous theoretical work lurking in the background on pluralism and liberalism. So I enjoyed that. I kind of thought that this was a little bit like, you know, you've written your social contract a la Rousseau. This was a little bit like your Constitution of Corsica. I don't know if that's an apt comparison or if that's an insulting comparison to be compared to Rousseau. But
I actually know Rousseau's Constitution of Poland a little bit better than I know his Constitution of Corsica. So I'm in no position to know just how insulting it is.
So normally I start by asking the motivation for writing the book, Bill. In some ways, I'm sure that motivation for many will be obvious because lots of people have wondered about the health of liberal democracy after the Trump election. But maybe you could say a little bit about how you particularly came to be driven to write this book.
Well, my interest in the topic of populism and its relationship to liberal democracy goes back some time now. I've been writing about the subject for about 5 years, but I've changed my mind about it very considerably. When I started writing around 2013, I thought it was principally an economic phenomenon, and I traced it to the enormous disruption caused by the incomplete transition from industrial to post-industrial economies throughout the West, and by the failure of governments and other major actors in society to help ease that transition for the people most affected by it. And so I saw it principally as an expression of deep economic discontent and a sense of abandonment by the powers that be. I think that view contains a portion of the truth, but over the past 5 years, in the process that led up to the actual writing of the book, I've been increasingly focusing on the role of what might broadly be called identity issues, but not as a general theoretical basket. I am increasingly struck by the role that the immigration issue, which ramifies into a number of different areas, has played in triggering populism. And I think the role of immigration in the rise of populism over the past decade is quite instructive as to its nature and also its danger. In my book, I describe my light bulb moment. I stayed up all night on June 23rd of 2016 to watch the BBC election return for the Brexit vote. I watched, jaws drop across the commentariat. And about 3 in the morning, it suddenly occurred to me, you know, if you change the accent in a few proper nouns, these folks can be talking about the U.S. presidential election. The very next morning, Donald Trump began describing himself as Mr. Brexit. And I took him seriously, but I should have taken him even more seriously than I did, because, in fact, the Brexit vote was more about immigration and national sovereignty issues than it was about the economic consequences of staying in or staying out. As a matter of fact, if the debate had only been about the economic consequences of staying in or staying out, I think the Remain vote would have prevailed. But that wasn't what tipped the balance. What tipped the balance was a sense on the part of so many British, ordinary British citizens and voters that they were, if the Brexit vote had simply been about the economic consequences of remaining in or remaining or leaving, I think the Remain vote would have prevailed. But what made the difference was the sense on the part of millions and millions of ordinary British voters and citizens, mostly outside the major metropolitan areas, that somehow they had lost control over their own country, that people were coming in from hither, thither, and yon, without any controls, without any government reflection on the consequences of new arrivals or people who had been in Britain, mainly in the same communities for many generations, and also that there was somehow a loss of sovereignty, that the British were no longer masters in their own domain. And the Brexit vote was really a protest against both of those. And in the ensuing years, we've seen the extraordinary power of the immigration debate in Europe, triggered by Angela Merkel's decision in the spring of 2015 to admit more than 1 million refugees, mainly from the Middle East, into Europe, without a lot of consultation with other countries or even with their own citizens. And the rubble is still bouncing from that decision in election after election, most recently in Italy and Sweden. So I began to weave the identity strand into my narrative. At the same time, I couldn't help noticing that a lot of the populist movements that had come to power in various European countries, come to power through purely democratic means, seemed to me to be governing in a less and less liberally democratic manner. And so I tried to understand as best I could what the relationship was between the motivation for this populist upsurge on the one hand and a distinctive mode of governance that began by being critical of the liberal dimensions of liberal democracy and ended up weakening even the democratic dimensions of liberal democracy. So that in brief, although I guess it wasn't so brief, was the motivation for my writing the book.
Yeah, that's great. I thought we could start with the notion of populism, which is in many ways at the heart of your book and the heart of many analyses of the contemporary moment. It's a kind of ambiguous concept, however, in the notion of populism. What do you mean by it?
It's an ambiguous concept in the sense, A, that there are a lot of competing definitions, and B, a lot of scholars don't think it really can be defined at all.
Right.
And I disagree with the latter proposition, and I have my own entry in the definitional sweepstakes. And I look at populism really from two different points of view along two dimensions. First of all, I array populism against what I diagnose as the essential building blocks of liberal democracy, which are, number one, the idea of popular sovereignty, the people as the sole source of legitimacy. Number two, the presumption in favor of equal political voice, at least formal political equality, the principle that everybody's vote is to count for one and nobody's for more than one. Third, the idea of constitutionalism as a set of entrenched institutions and procedures within which ordinary politics is supposed to transpire. And number four, the idea of liberalism as a limit on what would otherwise be the total power of government to enter into all domains of our lives, and how one goes about drawing the line between what is permissible for government to do and what is impermissible has exercised centuries of liberal theorists, but liberalism stands or falls with some distinction between the public realm and the non-public realm. And against that backdrop, I say, first as a formal matter, that populists are comfortable endorsing the first two of those principles, popular sovereignty and the presumption of equal political voice. They have a purely instrumental view of constitutionalism, which they really don't distinguish from ordinary legislation. Both are simply tools for the pursuit of governance as they define it, and they are critical about the liberal dimension of liberal democracy because they want to exercise control in various spheres, including, for example, free speech and freedom of the press, that liberal principles want to protect against that kind of intrusion. So from that standpoint, formally speaking, you could describe populism familiarly as illiberal democracy, the way Viktor Orban defines it, for example. But then you can't help noticing something else. And this is an idea that I first drew from the work of Jan Werner Muller, who's a theorist of populism and much else besides at Princeton University, to the effect that having endorsed the idea of the people as the source of sovereignty, populists then go on to employ a distinctive definition of the people. The populist definition of the people drives towards homogeneity. There is an implicit distinction between the real people and everybody else. There are the real people and then the others. And it's not hard to cross that bridge and see that and posit there's a clash between the people and the enemies of the people, a phrase that the current president of the United States by no means invented. And so populism usually involves a kind of ethnocentrism because the definition of the real people and most forms of populism revolves around questions of language, history, ethnicity, shared culture, etc. There are forms of populism that draw the line between the real people and the rest in other terms, and so a left populism will distinguish between the salt of the earth real people on the one hand and the millionaires and billionaires on the other, although somebody should tell Senator Sanders that anybody in Washington who owns a house is a millionaire, but is by no means an enemy of the people, but that's a different point. So I put these two dimensions of analysis of populism together to come up with my own take on it, which is that it's, at first glance, democracy shorn of its liberal and constitutional dimensions, but it's also, in the second step, it is the sovereign people shorn of their heterogeneity and reduced to the real people viewed in typically in homogeneous terms.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up a little bit on what you said about, well, I mean, I can see how your definition could fit quite well with, say, a Trump or an Orban, but I wonder how much it can be extended to a left populism like Bernie Sanders, you mentioned, Or I guess I started this podcast by comparing you to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who in some ways might be thought of as a sort of originary figure in left-leaning populism. At least on my reading and some others' reading, it's not clear how much, say, somebody like Rousseau or indeed even a Bernie Sanders is committed to a kind of a homogenous conception of the people. That might be more of a right-leaning version of populism. Do you put much stock in that distinction between a right and a left version of populism?
I think there's something to it, and I think it's fair to say that my analysis was moved more by the eruption of right populism than by the eruption of left populism. But I have to say that I regard, for example, Chavismo in Venezuela as at least as much a threat to liberal democracy as anything Viktor Orban is doing.
Right.
And in general, any definition of the people that tends to divide the populace very sharply into two groups, the real people and the enemies of the people, is one that's going to go down the same dangerous road. Because it suggests that there is, that there's no possibility of democratic discussion. If someone is the enemy of the people, then the point is not to break bread and find common ground. The point is to marginalize, expel, and destroy this alien element in the political system. And I do think that left and right populism have that Manichaean tendency in common, although the definition of the line of division is different as between the right and the left.
Yeah. So let's turn to thinking about, you give a number of accounts of why we're seeing the rise of populism now. And in your opening statement, you talked about the economic account that you started with, and you turned more towards a cultural or a identitarian approach. Could you expand a little bit on, you know, why we're seeing the rise of populism now? 2016, and not before. I mean, one of the fun games that a lot of people play is sort of which is more important, the economic or the cultural explanations.
Right, right, right. And you know, and I've come to a view on that subject, but I also have to acknowledge that in real life, there's a complex interaction between the two. Or put it this way, when I was a young political science graduate student 50 years ago, God save me, the pluralists, as that term was then defined, talked about cross-cutting cleavages as the basis of a healthy party system in a constitutional democracy. And what that meant to them was that the people, taken as a whole, were cut up into a myriad of different, what were called interest groups, variously defined. And you could be group A could be group B's enemy on one issue, but ally on others. And so, it was more like Brownian motion than a single front war with two entrenched armies. And what that meant in particular was that there were various sorts of cooperative ventures available across party lines, and that compromise between as well as within the parties was the name of the game. What you have right now is a situation in which all of the major divisions within Western democracies seem to be stacked on top of each other. They're not cross-cutting. They're mutually reinforcing. And so the people with cultural grievances are the same people with economic grievances. They're the same people who feel shut out by the discussion between the center-left and the center-right. They are the same people who feel silenced by norms of political correctness, a term which is by no means confined to political discourse in the United States. And similarly for lines of division, lines of division such as education, where the people with cultural grievances tend to be less educated people. There are also geographical differences. We are really, throughout the West, talking about a dividing line between large, diverse metropolitan areas on the one hand and the smaller towns and rural areas on the other. You can go from country to country in Europe and see how the capital cities and the major metropolitan areas are, by and large, bastions of anti-populism. And the beachhead populism are in the smaller towns and rural areas. And so all of these lines of division, as I say, are stacked on top of each other. They're mutually reinforcing. And it's that phenomenon that I think gives the particular intensity that we're now seeing to the populist challenge, because it's a challenge simultaneously on so many different fronts.
One question I had in your account here is sort of what role, you say, just broadly speaking, identity politics has played in the development of populism. One thing I think that others have talked about in the context of the rise of populism, but doesn't get as much play in your book, I think, is the sort of, I guess, the racial character to the, say, Trump electorate, the Trump voters. And some of those analyses of the development of that voting bloc. I mean, how do you see the identity politics as a kind of driver? I mean, one way to think about it is the Mark Lilla type view about problem with identity politics liberalism is that they caused their own downfall by emphasizing identity, which then got transferred over into a kind of white identity politics on the part of Trump, who ended up just doing it better. What's your take on that?
Among other things, I'm trying to develop an account of populism that is capacious enough to see what the European experience, the UK experience, and the American experience have in common. Mm. And so from that standpoint, America's racial problem emerges as a distinctive species within a common genus. So that's point number one. And certainly racial resentment played an important role in Donald Trump's rise. But I've just about finished reading a new book by John Sides, Michael Tesler, and Lynn Vavreck called Identity Crisis. And this book makes it clear, I find its evidence and argument pretty compelling, that what we're talking about in the American context is not simply racial resentment, it's also the kinds of fears triggered by immigration, which I believe, and I think President Trump believes, is the single most important and effective weapon that he has in his political armory. And also the residual but very powerful effects, the lingering effects of 9/11, which take the form of antipathy towards Muslims, fear of Muslim immigrants, etc. So identity politics in the immediate American political context is a trifecta of racial, ethnic, and religious. There's another dimension of identity which takes a particular form in the United States, but which is pretty nearly universal, and that is religious. It's a relatively recent development where liberals tend to be somewhat thin on religion, and traditionalists tend to be believers. But that's what's developed throughout most of the West. And if you take a look at Poland, an important case study. A lot of the populist, the rise of populism in Poland represents a traditionalist Catholic protest against the progressive cultural norms of the European Union, which Polish Catholics, many of them, believe are being imposed on Poland without the consent of the Polish people. So I don't want to deny the importance of identity, but I do want to put it not only in the appropriate American context, which is broader than race or gender, but also in the appropriate international context so that we can see what these different forms of right-leaning populism have in common.
Yeah, that's good. I wanted to spend a brief time on the European examples, because the American case is often, as you say, sort of discussed more at length. But the European examples, we see, say, Marine Le Pen in France, we see the Alternative für Deutschland in Germany on the rise, similar parties in Austria and elsewhere. What do you see as the most important drivers of these groups in Europe? Any sort of distinct or particular causes in Europe as opposed to the United States?
Europe has something that the United States doesn't have, at least in the same form, and that is a fundamental dispute about sovereignty. Populism in Europe is associated with regaining national sovereignty, weakening the European Union, and strengthening the control of individual peoples over their own national destiny. America First, the Trump slogan, has something in common with that, but the sovereignty issues that he's raising have less to do with the transfer of power to some distant capital than it does the constraining effects of international treaties, which don't transfer sovereignty so much as force the United States to consult with other countries before it does what it wants to do, and in some respects prevents us from doing precisely what we want to do. That's one of the distinctive elements of European populism, the pushback against the EU. That's obvious in the case of the Brexit vote in the UK, but in many of the other populist movements, the EU is used as a negative cultural symbol. Rather, most populist parties want to have it both ways. They want to bash the EU and get all the political advantages of tapping into that resentment without incurring the cost of withdrawing from the euro or from the EU, because most of the countries with populist governments receive huge net transfers from the European Union, and with Hungary being the single biggest beneficiary on a per capita basis. Mm. So it's a complicated situation.
Yeah, and I suppose I'm surprised in a way that European countries, let's say Western European countries, haven't elected a Trump. That, in other words, that the United States moved more towards a populist party sooner than Europe did. And I'm surprised at that because, in part, the EU is relatively recent, so it strikes me that shouldn't have had time to really be internalized in the European consciousness in quite a way, Western European countries have a stronger sense of, well, maybe this is contestable, but the stronger sense of nationalism and at least a sort of longer history with this. I mean, are you surprised by that too, or why do you think? I mean, the way I would have expected, like the AfD or some of these other parties to do have done better. Maybe that's my more pessimistic side coming out.
Populist governments are now firmly in place in three European countries, including the third largest. Mm. And in virtually every European country, the right-wing populist party is the fastest-growing party. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would describe the situation a little differently. And as for electing a Trump, Hungary has repeatedly, and he's much cleverer and more strategic than our Trump is. And I think in the end more dangerous, because he's proved very adept at propagating his message and becoming a point of reference for a number of other European countries in what they see as their struggle against an overweening European Union. So I guess I just disagree with you on factual grounds. And the fact that in Sweden, the populist anti-immigrant country is, rather party is now large enough to block the formation of a government, creating a political crisis in, this symbolic epicenter of Scandinavian social democracy, speaks volumes about where we are. And, to say nothing of the fact, nationally, some surveys now show the AfD as the second largest party in Germany. The SPD, the old Social Democrats, are imploding. In the most recent Bavarian elections, they got 10% of the vote.
And the Greens. And I saw the Greens did really well.
The Greens did better. Throughout Europe, social democratic parties are imploding. In 2012, or 2013, the French Socialist Party elected its leader as president. And then last year, it got 7% of the vote in the first round of the presidential election and didn't come close to making it into the second round. I could go on. So why is this happening? I have a kind of a silver bullet explanation, and that is, for decades, social democratic parties represented a coalition between left-leaning intellectuals on the one hand and working class on the other. And under the impact of profound economic change, the working class became increasingly discontented with parties of the left, which they saw as being ineffective in protecting their interests. And so once they left the social democratic parties, they didn't stop in the center. They headed all the way right, and allied themselves with conservative parties and increasingly with populist parties. And the same thing has happened in the United States, but more slowly.
That sort of gets to the point, I think, that you make about the elites, that the elites are, this is not just a book critiquing populism. It's also the elites are
sharing
some responsibility. So maybe you want to say a little bit about the elites. Yeah. I mean, I think about Merkel in Germany, who's got a really difficult situation. I got Emmanuel Macron in France, his approval rating is, 20%, 30%? I mean, it's extremely low, much lower than Trump's. So how have elites been part of the problem?
Well, I think there are three characteristics of elites that have created problems in the long run. First of all, in the area of culture, they are tone deaf to traditionalist claims. And I think on some level don't even understand them. Why some people would be reluctant about cultural innovations, such as much more freely available and accessible abortion rights, gay rights, same-sex marriage, animal rights, environmentalism, etc., etc. They simply can't understand why any right-thinking and decent person would disagree with them. So it's been a dialogue of the deaf. But more importantly, elites were blind for a very long time to the consequences of economic change for the working classes in their own countries. And I don't exempt the United States by any means, and I don't exempt my own political party by any means, because during the 1990s in the United States, there was this enormous confidence that we had the wind in our sails, that globalization and technological change would work to everybody's advantage, that a increasingly inclusive economic treaties and institutions would bring about the integration of the global economy and the increasing convergence of political systems as well. That was the ensemble of hopes that led to the enthusiastic inclusion of China in the international economic order, kept by its entrance into the WTO, the World Trade Organization, in 2001. Nobody noticed the fact that in the 6 years from China's accession to the WTO to the beginning of the Great Recession, we lost 3.3 million manufacturing jobs in the United States, almost 20% of our of the manufacturing base that we had in the year 2000. There was amazingly little discussion about this, even though it was an enormously disruptive episode for workers and communities throughout small town America, in the Midwest, in the Southeast, in Appalachia. By the time people started noticing it and talking about it, the horse was well out of the barn and galloping away. And belated efforts to catch up to the horse just looked equivocal and embarrassing. So, for example, when Hillary Clinton, as presidential candidate in 2016, ended up repudiating the very trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that she'd so enthusiastically backed and boosted as Secretary of State in the preceding 4 years. And the long and the short of it is that elites didn't know how to deal with the downside of globalization and technological change without succumbing to what they regarded as the most dangerous and retrograde impulses in the body politic. They were moved by the disastrous consequences of protectionism and economic nationalism in the 1930s, which had led to World War II and the ensuing catastrophes. They were determined never to repeat those mistakes, and they didn't, but they made mistakes of their own that had produced the current situation.
So I wanted to try to end in the last 20 minutes or so with maybe some sunnier assessments, some hope perhaps, but turn to the positive part of your book. Give a number of proposals about what we can do, what elites can do, what we can do in order to salvage the situation and address these challenges. So, I thought to start in general before we get into some of the particulars that you suggest, one of the things that struck me about your book was your vision of liberal democracy in what you call its incompleteness in the final chapter. And this is where I think some of your previous work on liberal pluralism comes to bear. But part of what you argue at that point in the book is that liberal democracy is incomplete in the sense that it cannot fully balance and perfect competing principles and goods, that at the end of the day, liberal democracy can't make us perfect. It can't create a utopia. It's going to leave us dissatisfied in some ways and perpetually open to the kind of tribal appeals that say a populist offers, that the individualism of liberal democracy means we're bereft of strong communal identification. One of the questions I had, maybe feel free to say a little bit more about the incompleteness point. Let me know if I had that right. Why doesn't this point towards an internal flaw in liberal democracy that we can and should overcome?
You know, it's an internal incompleteness, but in modern parlance, it's a feature, not a bug.
Right.
And so you can't overcome the incompleteness of liberal democracy without forfeiting the liberalism of liberal democracy, right? If you if you want an unending series of solidaristic experiences, liberal democracy is really not for you. Certainly, if you insist that those solidaristic experiences be at the national level, if you insist that politics be the expression of your deepest hopes and feelings, the liberal answer to that is that you've invested the wrong sphere with your hopes. That there are various other spheres, like religion, that can perform that function, or family, or various communal ventures, or even communities separated from the larger polity to the greatest extent possible, the various sorts of utopian communities that Americans have tried out in over the course of the past two centuries, etc. But asking that the nation as a whole be the expression of your deepest hopes and sentiments is to ask of liberal politics what in principle it cannot deliver, because in the liberal polity, you have people with different hopes and dreams and sentiments. And if we are all clashing to inscribe our own hopes and sentiments as dominant and normative for the society as a whole, then you come to grief within a liberal framework, and you have to choose between retreating and acknowledging that your hopes and sentiments are part of a larger whole, a very pluralist whole, or imposing your will on other people without their consent in areas where you have no right to do that. That's the choice. So liberalism requires a kind of moderation of hopes from politics. And it's immoderate hopes for politics that lead to dangerous politics. That's the liberal account, and I have to say I believe it.
So what is the source of attachment or loyalty, on your view, or the most durable source of attachment or loyalty to liberal democracy? Is it a sort of self-interest, rightly understood, or kind of prudential or modus vivendi?
I think, first of all, it's gratitude for the extent to which liberal democracies allow us as individuals and as groups to live out our own hopes and dreams. And it provides a number of spheres to do that, and it provides a number of protections against people who would try to prevent you from doing that in the name of imposing their own hopes and dreams on you. So it's not simply material satisfaction, although over the past two or three centuries, rising levels of material satisfaction and liberal democracy have become increasingly closely associated. We can have a long conversation as to whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, but there it is. Mm. I would also say that the principles that allow liberal democracies to give us all not total freedom of self-expression, but a very substantial protected sphere of self-expression are themselves worthy of admiration and support. So our gratitude can be not only an experiential gratitude, but also a principled gratitude.
Yeah, and perhaps those principles can be the source of some meaning in our lives. I think of a form of liberalism that maybe, even if it shouldn't be the sort of centerpiece of the meaning of our life, it can provide some. I think, again, of this sort of Sanders populism, left-leaning populism, and maybe I'm trying to imagine a kind of left-leaning critic of your book saying, look, we can still develop some, I mean, it's still important to attach ourselves to the community, to form democratic associative bodies, to improve citizenship, and all that requires that we actually find in politics some durable sense of meaning?
Nothing that I've said denies the possibility that people in political life can find a durable sense of meaning in it, and so can ordinary citizens. And so, for example, if you cherish the principles of liberal democracy, then you can't help seeing the extent to which the actualization of those principles in the United States and elsewhere has fallen short. Mm. And you can dedicate yourself to a life of narrowing that gap. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's completely honorable, and many of our greatest leaders have done exactly that. And in so many words, you know, Martin Luther King's famous metaphor of, you know, the promissory note that America issued to African Americans, which is now called upon to redeem. King wasn't saying rip up your founding principles and adopt others. He was saying live up to your founding principles. Be yourselves, or be the highest version of yourself. Anybody who was alive during the period in which he was alive, and conducting his mission to America, can remember the power of that very simple claim, right? We don't need a cultural revolution. We need a national reconciliation with its own principles and the meaning of its own principles. So this is not a transactional account of liberal democracy. It's just an account that distinguishes between what liberal politics can do and what in principle it can't.
Good. Yeah, so I thought we could turn to some of the particulars of your policy proposals in the book, which I found very interesting. I mean, first to start on the economic side of mm-hmm, things, mm-hmm, what, one of the most important, I think, or most pervasive sort of suggestions that you have has to do with, on the one hand, economic growth, or promoting economic growth, and on the other hand, promoting equitable distribution of that economic growth.
Well, I would put it differently.
Okay.
My operative phrase is inclusive growth.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Which is not necessarily a distributional principle, but it is the proposal of a new metric for judging whether we're making progress or not. And that is, when the economy grows, do people across the broad spectrum of occupations and classes participate in and benefit from that growth? Or do some people get it and others not? And if that's the situation, and that's the situation which to a considerable extent we've been in now, for nearly a quarter of a century, then we have to take a new look at the policies that we've adopted and the trends that we've tolerated that have produced non-inclusive economic growth. I think to the extent that I add anything to the discussion other than the phrase inclusive growth, which I did not invent, it's the idea that there is a dimension of non-inclusion that goes beyond what you can read on the income distribution tables and has to do with the geography of disadvantage. I've studied this quite carefully and have a long co-authored paper coming out on the subject next month. But certainly over the past 20 years or so, the growth that we've enjoyed, if that's the right verb, because it hasn't been very robust, has been more and more concentrated in a handful of metropolitan areas, and huge swaths of the country have either stagnated or have actually fallen back. And that's part of what is going on in American politics today, where those people who also have cultural complaints and complaints about immigration have gathered under a single banner to demand, and this is the positive side of what they're asking for, demand fuller inclusion in the fruits of the American economy. I think that's a perfectly legitimate demand. And in order to bring small towns in rural America back into the larger economy, we're going to have to pay real attention to the importance of place in American life, as Franklin Roosevelt did when he authorized and established programs such as the Rural Electrification Administration, which was designed to wire up America. People in the most remote backwaters and hollows of the country, not only to give them more economic opportunity, but to connect them to the wider society. If you have electricity, you could listen to FDR's fireside chats, but you could also participate in American culture more broadly. So thinking very consciously about the importance of excluded places as well as excluded groups is a big part of what I focus on in the economic section, but I also talk about inclusion in the more traditional sense. If corporations are making huge profits in part because they enjoy increasingly concentrated roles within economic sectors, and competition in those sectors is going down, then there ought to be formal mechanisms whereby workers can participate in the fruits of corporate profits, their forms of profit sharing, share distribution, and a number of other mechanisms that would enable workers' lives to improve and their savings for the future to swell as corporations do well. There was a very interesting story just a couple of days ago, a comparison between Sears and Amazon. You could say that Amazon is the Sears of the 21st century, but its relationship with its workers is very different. And Sears, in fact, did share profits and stock with workers, and many Sears workers in the old days retired with accounts that were very substantial and healthy by today's standards, and that's because the company took the view that it had some responsibility to its workers and not just its shareholders, and we need, in a relevant 21st century way, to go back to that older notion of who the stakeholders in corporate America actually are. I could go on, but that was just...
I mean, I find this general idea to be quite interesting because I think you are making more of a contribution than you're modestly letting on. I mean, because lots of us talk about the problem of inequality in America, and often the immediate response to that problem is to think about, as I mentioned earlier, is schemes of state redistribution of income or wealth transfers in order to address the problem. But the problem with that is it doesn't really, I think, address the sort of underlying moral psychology that I think you're getting at, which is a sense that a sense of self-worth or self-respect is connected with earning one's income.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head there. In fact, I am noticing that books and studies are coming out across the political spectrum that are focusing on work as a source of dignity, self-respect, full membership in society, and the importance, therefore, of allowing as many people as possible to enjoy that sense of dignity and self-worth. And which is, so it's a focus, it's a focus on job generation and job security and not simply economic growth as measured by the GDP as one of the key benchmarks of a healthy economy. And I am just fascinated in the past week or two, and I've been talking to everybody about this, the extent to which the centrality of work is a spreading idea, and it can take a liberal form and a conservative form. Conservatives say expect work. Liberals say provide work. Well, there's no necessary contradiction between those two ideas.
Right.
I am hopeful enough to believe that after we finish beating each other's brains out, maybe we can come together on ideas that are really both and rather than either or, if you look at them carefully.
You just say a little bit about immigration and immigration.
Yeah, reform. Yeah. I've worked on immigration now for 10 years. Suffice it to say, and some recent work I've done has confirmed me in this view, that there is a broad cross-section of the American people that is open to and more than ready for an honorable compromise on the issue of immigration. You know, Donald Trump is not entirely wrong when he says, if you don't have a border, you don't have a country. There's a lot of human experience and political theory behind that. He is almost entirely wrong in his characterization of the impact of immigration on American society. Nonetheless, we are still operating within a framework of an immigration reform bill that was passed 53 years ago. And it's certainly time to update it. And I've argued that we can do a lot worse than to take a look at what the Canadians have done in the past quarter century, because they transformed an immigration system that was very unpopular into one that has enjoyed stable popularity for nearly 20 years. They focused much more on economic contribution as a criterion of immigration, of cultural integration as a criterion of immigration, and much less on family reunification than we do. I think we could think hard about the Canadian example as a possible model for the reform of our own system. At the same time, I think everybody agrees, and certainly the senators who voted for a bipartisan immigration compromise in 2013, every single Democrat, 14 Republicans, believed that enforcement of law, both at the border and in the workplace, was essential to the restoration of public confidence in our immigration system. So I don't want to get into the weeds on immigration policy, because that would take another hour. Mm-hmm. But I really do believe, and I've been doing survey research on this subject for 5 years, and I'm convinced that 60% plus of the American people are ready for an honorable compromise on immigration. And it is the structure of our political system that prevents that majority from getting its way on this issue and many others as well.
Okay, Bill, last question, although maybe this is a question I should ask after the election is over, but here it goes anyway. How hopeful are you about the future?
Let me put it this way. Every great religion teaches that despair is a sin. And I'm not sure that I believe that for religious reasons, but perhaps for much more empirical reasons. When an old order is upended, you experience an immediate sense of confusion and dismay as established benchmarks disappear. You feel disoriented. It's not clear what the way forward is. There's a period of intense, constant contestation and discomfort. Gradually, the history of democracy suggests a country, to paraphrase Winston Churchill, after making all possible mistakes, stumbles on some operative truths about the way forward. I think we're in one of those transition periods now. I will not venture to predict how long it's going to take us to get out of it. And I don't know exactly what the path forward is going to look like. All I know is that more than two centuries of pessimists have gone broke betting against American democracy. That may turn out to be the right bet this time, but you need a very compelling argument as to why the current moment is different from every other moment of difficulty in our history. Granted, there was one moment in our history where no peaceful means of adjudication could settle our disputes. And I have noticed recently and even written about the fact that the phrase civil war is appearing much more in speeches, in newspaper articles, in magazine pieces, et cetera, than I've ever seen, or maybe not since 1968. So there is a sense that we are on the edge of something even worse than what we're now seeing. Maybe I can remember what 1968 felt like. I was a young graduate student at the University of Chicago, and quite frankly, it felt as though the entire country was coming apart at the seams. That felt even worse than it feels now, if I'm allowed you know, comparative assessment of discontent. And we somehow figured out how to get through that. It wasn't pretty. And we had to remove the president in the process. But I think there are grounds for hope, even if I can't define clearly the path along which hope lies.
Well, Bill Galston, I really enjoyed this, so thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Association for Political Theory for promoting the show. And thanks to you for listening.